Good afternoon, brothers and sisters, distinguished guests, and fellow speakers. We extend a warm welcome to the panel discussion on Tibet in India's geopolitical vision, the centrality of Tibet in India-China relationship. This meaningful dialogue is jointly organized by the Foundation for Nonviolent Alternative and the Future of Tibet team, led by a group of concerned Tibetan and our friends, including Mr. Wangpo Chatongla and Ripon Man, and others. We are privileged to have two esteemed speakers with us today. We'd like to express our sincere gratitude for their willingness to be part of this critical discussion. And let's begin with a brief overview of today's timetable of this panel discussion. From 2 to 2:30 p.m., our panelists will present their topics. I will be asking them questions throughout, and each of the speakers will be allotted 10 minutes to speak, and I humbly request both of our speakers to please follow this time limit so that we can have plenty of time for the question and answer session. And following this, from 2:30 to 3:00 p.m, the floor will be open to you all, our valued attendees, to ask questions and comments. We encourage your active participation throughout this interactive segment. I'd like to introduce both our speakers first. So our first speaker is Ripon Banerjee-Dhar, ma'am. So she is the founding trustee of FNBA, and she has worked and continued to work passionately in shaping and supporting the Tibetan freedom movement for a long, long time. And as she worked with the German Living Foundation devoted to freedom for 17 years, worked under the banner of International Tibet Support Group for a long time, and spearheaded about like 6 parliamentary conferences for the support of Tibet and its freedom. And she has also formulated several policy documents and also helped in training our young Tibet in the field of public advocacy, public communication, and leadership. So after relinquishing her job with the German Foundation, she, along with others, has established an institution called the Foundation for Nonviolent Alternative, where she continues to work for Tibet on a broader and a larger context. So, our second speaker is Mr. Lobsang Gyaltso Sikar, who is currently a member of Parliament, Tibetan Parliament in Exile. So, Mr. Sikar was named as one of the 32 innovators building a better future as part of Wired 2021 Smart List. And he has extensive experience in Tibetan freedom movement, especially in the field of cyber and digital security faced by the Tibetan community. He is also currently leading 2 major Tibetan institutes as the digital security program director of the Tibet Action Institute, where he worked for 12 years, and director for TIPSART for more than 5 years now. So he has worked and continued to work with key community and numerous civil society organization at the Tibetan community. And with that, I would like to begin this session by engaging in this small exercise. So within this exercise, I would like to set a future scenario, request our audience and our panel speaker to imagine where and what India and Tibet would look like in 2040. So personally, I optimistically think that by 2040, India would have already become a superpower with a global influence and power, and Tibet would gain its freedom back from China. And so with that, I would like to briefly ask both of our speakers to please share their view about what Tibet and India would look like in 2040, just briefly before we begin our session.
Yes. Yes, good afternoon. Sorry about that. So I'll just repeat. Yes, I mean, if we are on the right trajectory and nothing really derails us, we might continue on the path to become the second largest economy in the world. That comes, along with it comes a lot of responsibilities as well. Maybe at that point, we are in a better position to confront China than we are at the moment today, as Ambassador Kanwar-Sibal mentioned. Maybe at that time, we can have independent policy for Tibet, instead of it being a policy of no policy, or instead of it being a policy of containment, you take recourse to Tibet every time China rears its ugly head across the mountains. Maybe at that time we are in a better position to look at Tibet for what Tibet is, you know, not what it can do against China or what it can do with us, for us, when it comes down to, you know, dealing with China in adversarial positions. So that is one aspect. What I think of Tibet, that is a bit of a tricky question. And I do not know which side of the fence to really be on. On one hand, I think if China continues, you know, one gets news from China that it is not as strong as it used to be, the party is not strong, there's so much of infighting, and the economy, as Ambassador mentioned, the whole demographics, you know, being on the other side of the curve. If things really develop to our favor, maybe Tibet does become a lot more, you know, freer. I do not know about independent, but a lot freer. But on the other side, I would imagine when we approach a time when, may His Holiness live as long as possible, but when we are at a time when he passes on, could China become even more repressive inside Tibet? Because that leading golden light is no more with us. Could that be a situation? So it's more like a question than giving you the answer, really.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, ma'am, for this insightful, not a forecast, but like what could be the future like?
Hello. Can you hear me? First of all, thank you to FNVA and the Future Tibet team for having me here and giving me this opportunity to share some of my views. In terms of the question that you asked about, like, what do I think about 2014? So I want to state that, like, I have a few different opinions or thoughts about that. In terms of what I want to state is, I don't think of any of these instances as something that's either and or, because I think it can be all of the combinations or can be something that will happen in its own vacuum without having the other things happen. So first thing that I do think about India, as Vipinji, as you mentioned, that India is going to be, in terms of economy, as we can see in the last few years, how it has developed, and I think a lot is changing, especially with the supply chain and all of that. So it is going to be one of the largest economies in the world, and that is going to drastically change how India is at the world stage. Though there is a question about whether that will actually translate with how it actually deals with China. Because if you look at like what Ambassador said this morning about the Honorable Foreign Minister J.S. Shankar and his statements globally about the U.S., about Canada, or Ukraine, or a lot of those issues, and how confident and how on an equal footing India is at a lot of these stages, but with China it hasn't been the same. So in 2040, will that actually change or not? I don't think it's about whether it's about economy, I think it might be about mindset, and whether that will change is a different question. So I think that is one thing. At the same time, I think the border dispute will intensify, because I do believe that, as many have noted, there is going to be a lot of changes in China, and that will intensify a lot of border dispute, because internal strife is always overshadowed by external issues. So there's always the option of, from the Chinese perspective, of making external things and talking about nationalism and all of that to kind of like expedite or talk about that and to keep it short. So I think that's something that I see will happen with India. In terms of the CTA, or I think when you talk about Tibet, very short, I think the resistance inside Tibet will continue, because I think one thing that we have to realize is like the identity, the culture, the language and religion of Tibetans are all interconnected. So I think that is something that is very distinct with the Tibetan culture, like all language, all identity, all religion. So even though there's a lot of issues inside Tibet right now, especially with a lot of boarding schools and the destruction of Tibetan language and the religion, but because all these are connected, I think ultimately it will come back. I mean, it's not come back, but it'll be there. So basically, like, I think to look at history, like if you look at 1959, 87, 2008, even with a lot of the intensification of the Chinese oppressive policies, things will come back, and I think that's one thing to highlight. So anyways, the time is
okay. I think that, is it all okay if we reduce the time by 10 minutes to 7 minutes for the speaker session? Okay. Okay, so we'll begin with our first speaker, Ms. Repon. Madam Repon, to please begin. I'll set the timer.
I have not seen such openness towards Tibet since 2020. And it was really a pleasure to, you know, have Tibetan brothers and sisters appearing on mainstream TV channels or News Time and so on. That's something which I have never really experienced in all these years. That leads me to the fact that, you know, come 2020, Galwan and Government of India opened Tibet. But is that a very consistent policy? You know, does Government of India really have something in black and white where it looks at Tibet independent of the PRC? I don't know. And it is not evident. It has not been evident to us in these 25 to 30 years that we've been working. And in that effort, we did try, as Mr. Tandon spoke when he introduced the foundation right in the beginning, we did try our best to come up with a comprehensive policy document. And I would strongly request you to at least read through, if not get a copy. It's also available in PDF form. You can also find this on our website, where we, you know, really given reasons and justifications, well, not justifications, really compelling reasons why India should really look at Tibet as independent from the PRC, why it should really have a clear-cut policy in dealing with Tibet and its borders, what it can do for, you know, Tibetans living inside Tibet, and what it could also do, perhaps, you know, as an extension, what it could do inside Tibet as well. So our feedback has been pretty positive. We've been able to meet with lots of who's who in the corridors of power, and they have actually surprisingly read the report and have asked us pretty pertinent questions to some of the recommendations that we have put in, especially connecting to His Holiness's succession, if I may say so. So that's a area which I think has got everybody in knots. And I think the Government of India could easily, you know, put out a statement in times to come, stating that the succession issue is a prerogative of, you know, the Tibetans, prerogative of the people that His Holiness has set the responsibility to, and that it is, you know, not anyone else's responsibility or interest to influence that process, and we should just, you know, respect the outcomes of His Holiness's decisions. I think that is something which the Government of India could easily do. And perhaps even a statement to this effect, but in the parliament could be a welcome step. Right now, India has got quite an active all-party parliamentary forum for Tibet, so maybe they could come to the rescue. There are other issues, I think, where India could also, you know, help in. For example, you have, you know, fast-tracking the exit policy, that, you know, the exit permit. Tibetans, you know, things which are, you know, can be really done away with, or the return visa while traveling abroad for Tibetans on IC and so on. But the more fundamental question is, can and will India do something, you know? Is it in a position to do something now? And I think one should also look at the fact that, you know, we will be faced with a very unprecedented situation in the next 15, 20 years, and I think we all should be extremely prepared for that situation to come. Really, are we prepared as individuals, as organizations, to face that eventual situation? What are we doing? at the local level? How are we reaching out to international governments? How are we preparing governments to face that eventuality? What would we want the government, US, UK, French government, the German government, what have you? How do we want them to, you know, treat that vacuum? How do we want them to treat the situation? Or how do we expect them to welcome the 15th? You know, how those are, there's a huge plan, there's a huge vacuum I think we need to really look at. And I also think India should, of course, play a role there. But will other countries also support India when it raises its voice on Tibet? I don't think India will speak on Tibet or can speak today on Tibet independently. So will other countries help India? Would it support India when it speaks openly and positively for Tibet? Would they want to stick their neck out? What will it be in it for them to stick their neck out for Tibet? I think these are some fundamental questions that we really need to look at. And I think one question that always strikes my mind is, the world has just changed in the last 2 years. First we had, you know, Ukraine, which took a whole lot of media space, you know, print space, airspace, you know. Then we had other movements coming in and taking the space that Tibet had all these years. And we really felt the heat of it, you know. Press and media really focused on the other movements other than Tibet. And we felt the difference. Now you have the Middle East. So where will Tibet be in all this? You know, how do we bring, you know, the attention of the world leaders, of the media back onto Tibet? What would be, how do we reposition Tibet internationally? Would it mean repackaging Tibet in a more effective manner? In other words, how do we plug Tibet where, you know, the attention is back on Tibet? So I think even the Tibet support groups, the Tibet movement, I think may have to change gears and relook at the whole the Tibet movement, the freedom movement, slightly differently. You know, everything has to change with time. So yeah, so that's
okay, ma'am, thank you for your insightful presentation. I would like to hand this mic to the second speaker.
Thank you, Indra. Hi. Yeah, I was a bit rushed in the earlier question, so I'll try to make sure that I'm as brief as possible. So the question was, the question that I've been thinking about is like the centrality of Tibet on the India-China relationships. And this morning, Ambassador mentioned about how Tibet was central because India never had a border with China. It was always an Indo-Tibet border. However, the wording here is was. And I think that was something that was also part of the question was like, Tibet was centrality, right? And also, I think as part of the conversation was also about, there were certain things that were kind of talking about like how Tibet has to be a central, I mean like in terms of the centrality of Tibet. So I think the question that I was thinking about this and my kind of gut reaction was, I think we are thinking of it in a, from a perspective of that the status quo, whatever the status quo right now is, will not change. And I think that is something that I think we need to change our mindsets about, first and foremost. Because if we kind of think about why can't there ever be an Indo-Tibet border, or is it always going to be an Indo-China border? So I think that's one question that we need to understand. And the second thing is, what about the Tibet issue, right? And there's two schools of thought in that. And in, even in the Tibetan community, we talk about the independence movement or the middle way. And there is, in my opinion, the reservation of Tibet issue, whether through either of these means, will solve the border issue. And I think that is something that has to be understood because there might be challenges in how this is understood from an emotional perspective. We have to understand how the border areas are culturally connected to Tibet and whether Tibet actually has genuine autonomy or receives complete independence.
the issue of the border will be solved at that point. And I think there's that understanding, or even discussions that I've had with others, where we talk about the fact that only if Tibet becomes independent will the border issue be resolved. So if that was the case, so the reason why I'm talking about all these is because the status quo, it's, even if it is a status quo, there are different ways of how the status quo might change. So I think we need to think about that. And when we're talking about the future, I think this is something that is something that comes to mind. And to kind of go back, I think I'm a Tibetan that was born in India. I was born in exile. Like I did all my schoolings in the Tibetan schools, in TCV. The education that was given to me, a lot of that support came from the Indian government. Whatever I am right now, there's a lot of, I owe a lot to His Holiness, but also to the Indian government. And I think that is, and however, the other flip side of that is, Tibetans have also sacrificed a lot for India. So I'm grateful, but at the same time, Tibetans have also sacrificed. If you look at the 1972 Bangladesh War, if you look at Galwan, if you look at all these different issues, Kargil, and even if you look, think about how His Holiness the Dalai Lama has been a global ambassador for India's plurality, India's democracy. So I think in this way, what I'm trying to say here, that this is not about what India can do for Tibet or what Tibet can do for India. It's about a partnership. Even though it will not be an equal partnership, but it is still a partnership. In the terms of the partnership, I think we have to rethink about how we move forward. So even though it can be a moral question, but I think it's about Tibet has to be part of the geopolitical question in terms of what happens to Tibet does matter to India. And even if what happens inside Tibet not exactly the way that the Indian government wants, if it can happen in a different way, how does that impact India? And I think we have to think about the cultural affinity or the cultural relationships between Tibetans, between His Holiness the Dalai Lama, between people in Arunachal Pradesh, between people in Ladakh, people in like a lot of the border areas. How does that relationship happen? What does that relationship impact the border issues? And I think we need to think about a lot of these things to actually understand where we might be able to go. So I just wanted to talk about that as a perspective of rethinking and maybe from a mental perspective of thinking about the relationship in a different way. And secondly, I think I was recently listening to some podcast by Takshila, which was a public policy school in it's a public policy school in Bangalore. And there's a lot of other discussions that happens on China. And there's a lot of policy discussions about China and what it entails. It talks about the BRI, it talks about a lot of different issues, Xi Jinping's school of thought, his kind of thoughts and how that is being imparted in the schools or imparted in like different spaces. However, one thing that was missing was, or I think that required or that needed was the Tibetan context. So for example, if you think about Xi Jinping's thought and how that is being pushed across all over China, Tibet and others, the biggest resistance to that is inside Tibet. And you can see the impact of that with the colonial boarding schools. There's about 1 million Tibetan children being put up in boarding schools because Xi Jinping's school of thought is not being implemented. People are not listening to it. So they're trying to change the schools. They're trying to change children from a young age. So I think those kind of impact and what that actually means for Xi Jinping, what he thinks about that, I think is important to understand, because when we talk about global politics, there's always the analytical part of it, right? We talk about economics, we talk about a lot of things. However, human beings are emotional. So we really have to understand the emotions behind it. What does that mean when it's not happening inside Tibet? What does that mean when there's resistance inside Tibet after so much economic development? So I think we have to look at all these different aspects to understand the impact of those and how those, I think in some ways, how that can be used to further the Tibet movement. And I think if you look at the India context, right? So for example, I recently had the opportunity to go to IIT Madras and meet Professor Sonika Gupta and kind of hear about the work. And they have a program in IIT Madras Country Tibet as part of their studies on Southeast Asian studies. And I think that is something that is really critical because it talks about why Tibet is central to the Indo-China relationship. Because even though we can talk about it, but if it's not really in the narrative, it's not really in the academic space, then it becomes more like, yes, we can talk about Tibet. We can talk about Tibet in a way that is more about the moral values and the moral responsibility. But I think from a geopolitical stand, I think we have to think about how that actually makes sense in the geopolitical sense. And just to kind of like quickly, one or two more points. I think as Rabinji, you mentioned, I think India really needs to take a stand on the His Holiness reincarnation and have a really strong statement, because a lot of other countries are looking to India for leadership. And I think a lot of like European countries, Southeast Asian countries are looking to India for leadership in this space. And this is not something that's controversial. And I think this is something that the US has already done. So I think being cautious and saying that this is something controversial is also something from our perspective is a mindset. So this is nothing there. It's about the reincarnation of His Holiness. His Holiness stated like how he will reincarnate when he is 90. And there's a tradition of that. And I think making a statement that you will support what His Holiness says, I don't think there's anything controversial about it. And I think those are certain things that I think we need to change the way that we think about these things. And I think lastly, I think one thing was on a very smaller note was like, if you look at the TRP, like the Tibetan Rehabilitation Policy Act of 2014, which was, I think was a milestone for the sustainability of the Tibetan movement and the Tibetan diaspora in India. However, I think it was something that there are still challenges in how it's being implemented and like certain aspects of it. However, a lot has changed since 2014, and I think it really needs a amendment and to figure out, because there's a huge growth of Tibetans leaving India, and this has nothing to do with like the political situation. It's more about economic gains. It's a lot of different reasons for that. However, that is something that is happening. So in that regard, I think there is going to be a fundamental change in how CTA functions, the Tibetan government in exile functions. And for me, as I think about it, I feel that we are always going to have the Tibetan government in exile is going to have its base in India, in Dharamsala. However, in terms of the departments and the structures, it has to go through a complete revamp. What we have right now is not sustainable for the next 10 to 15 years because the population is changing. At the same time, the Tibetan Parliament in exile, where I'm a part of, as a member of parliamentarian, the structure that we have is not representative. And it's not representative of the fact that there are almost 50% of Tibetans living outside. So it has to go through a change. Because the thing is, like, you get, the parliament gets its power from the people that it represents. And if you're not able to represent the people, I think you need to understand, you need to rethink how the structural shift or structural changes need to be made. And that doesn't mean that like we should stop the structural that we have, where we represent Tibetans inside Tibet, because it has to remain in that way. However, the exact structure can and must change. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Sitarla, for your very insightful presentation, a very passionate one. Yeah, so now I think it's already time for the Q&A session. So I would like our audience, if there's any question, to please raise their hand. Yeah.
I have a quick comment, which you can take as a question, and then I have a question appended with it. I think that Himalayas and the Trans-Himalayan regions of India are central to India's Tibet policy. Whether to what extent, whatever extent the policy is framed or narrated or explained. So if we see from that perspective, before 2014, India's concerns around the Himalayan borders were very different from what they were after 2014. And that has got to do a lot with the Chinese activities on the border, which have tremendously increased since 2014. So, and then another aspect about the Indian communities. So how whatever is happening on the border is going to directly have an impact on the life of the Indian communities on the border. I think that is also integral to it. So somewhere I see that maybe the policy is not there because India's entire focus on the Himalayan region was very different from policy perspectives earlier, as it is now. So I think, have you kind of thought about it? That is my first question. Second thing is, I feel that the Indians can have a concern. Now, this is my perspective, because Sibyl sir was also talking about a few things. He said that this comes under the Ministry of External Affairs, it comes under the Indian intelligence agencies, and then it is overseen by the PMO. So I think if I am looking at it, then I would want to look at how the policy will be impacted by the concerns of each of these institutions, right? Now, one thing which I have a question about in this context is, the Tibetan institutions are centralized in India, right? But right from the 19th century, the entire world and different world powers, they have different interests in Tibet. They have explored Tibet in various ways, and all those, that is documented. Russians have massive content on it. I do not know how much, you know, we have tapped into. Other European powers, you know, they had their expeditions into Tibet. Why were they doing? Because there was something about it. That is why they were exploring this region. So I do not think that there is a break in that. I feel that the different global powers still have their research, concerns, and policies on Tibet. But because the Tibetan institutions are centralized in India, has the Tibetan community considered this, that this would have a policy impact on the Indians? Because within the Tibetan community in India, you would have different narratives, right? And there are many narratives impacted by different global powers who are facilitating your discussions, creating your institutions, platforms, funding you. So when I listen to Mr. Sibyl, the institutions that he highlighted, I feel that, if you can take it as a question, have you thought about their concerns, which could be very genuine from India national security perspective? Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for the questions. And I think, let me just go to the second point first. So in terms of the centralization of institutions and how it impacts, I think the Tibetan community, as well as the Tibetan government in exile, and like the CTA, or if you want to call it, or and His Holiness, have always considered that. And that is sometimes, I feel, and I don't want to say overcautious, but I feel that we have always kept that in consideration. So whether it's about questions about India's border, or Nachal, and all of those, a lot of those things, as you might have known, in terms of the narratives, I think that has always been there. If you look at like globally, if you look at like His Holiness' statement about democracy, religious harmony, secularism, and all of that, have always kept that narrative and have kept those in considerations, right? And even at the point of like where, if you think about like in the 1950s, like where we first came into, like if you look at informal discussions about how India has supported like the Tibetan community from a perspective of education, the social support, there's always that lacking in some political will. However, that narrative has never really permeated beyond that smaller discussion. And it's not something that I'll even have like talked more about. So I think this is something that I think that narrative has always been something that has been important. And India, Tibetans have never really interfered in the Indian space, right? In terms of like trying to use our narratives to kind of pit someone against each other. It has always been focused more on like all the different political parties and all of that, right? So I think that is something there that I think we have kept that in consideration, and whether that has been the best use or whether that could have been done different, I think those are, I think it's like, I think vision, 2020 vision is the, you can always talk about like what happened in the 50s and 60s, you could have done that in a different way. However, I think that is something that has always been part of it. In terms of this second, I think it was more an opinion. So I think, yeah, I think if you look at like the Trans-Himalayan policy and like if you think about the Chinese incursions, yes, I think that is something that has changed in India in terms of how India reacts to China, how India thinks about China, and that has changed a lot because for a very long time, it was happy with the status quo. And because the status quo has changed, so I think there is a rethink, and I think that is always going to be happening. So in the same way, when I talk about like the Indo-Tibet or like the Chinese occupation of Tibet, that can change. And I think that is something that we have to understand because I think there is that attitude that this is something that is constant. So I think the occupation of Tibet by China will change. And I think that is something that you have to think about policies in that way. So it's similar in that way.
Thank you. Ma'am, do you have...
I think it's always been the other way around. I think I can only give my examples pertaining to Dharamsala. I think Dharamsala has been always very cautious when it comes down to, you know, making any statements or policies. It's always been very cautious, ensuring that, you know, it doesn't interfere in India's foreign affairs or internal politics. There's always been a very open channel of communication between New Delhi and Dharamsala. That's been always appreciated by people here in Delhi. So I think there's been no interference from that side. And yeah, so that is just to give you an idea. I don't think the government of India really had a hill policy, a Himalayan policy. I think they've just woken up after 70 odd years that they really need one. They started off by instituting Himalayan universities. They've got one now in Leh, they've had one in Sikkim, and Arunachal, and so on. But to our horror, we realized that none of these hill institutes have a different syllabus to universities in the plains. So universities, let's say in Delhi, they do not have a syllabus which looks at their rich repository of culture, heritage, history. There is no documentation of all that, but they continue having the same syllabus as chemistry and physics and what have you, you know. So I think that also needs to be changed. And I think there was also a talk, I'm not too up to date with it, but I think there was also a talk of having a hill ministry, you know, of all the hill states or the Himalayan hill states, to have a separate ministry for them. So I think they're also waking up on that front. Thank you,
ma'am. With that, I would also like to ask a question for both of our speakers. It's about the period after His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. So it's an old report, but I think it's a very relevant report. The report is titled Tibet and India Security, Himalayan Region, Refugees and Sino-Indian Relations. So it was presented to the Indian Parliament more than 10 years ago by the Institute of Defense and Security and Analysis, which is one of the most prestigious research institute. And in that report, which was presented to the Parliament, they have made like many assumptions about what could the post-Dalai Lama scenario would look like. So I'm going to just read out like four major assumptions. So the first one was that there would be a vacuum in power after His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, and that within the Tibetan society there would be conflict between the Tibetan government in exile and even maybe with the 17 Karmapa also. So that was the first assumption. And the second was that the cap, the lead on Tibetan militancy will be off, and that the Tibetan freedom movement can turn into more open political and more armed struggle even. So this was the assumption that was made. And the third was that that there might be two successors because from the Chinese side they will choose their own Dalai Lamas, and from Tibetan side also we'll choose our own, which okay. So and the last one was that if conflict of interest grows between the Tibetan society and the local people over here in India, so there might be a situation where the Tibetan would be then asked to go back to Tibet under China from India. So these were the assumptions that was made within this important report 10 years ago. So I would like to ask both of your opinion on these assumptions. Are these rooted in misunderstanding, or are these like a possible outcome in future?
Yes, for sure there will be two Dalai Lamas, one which is fostered by China, and then we have our own. But there's also a possibility that the 15th could also come up from the ranks of the Shukden followers, because there's a sizable amount in the PRC. So that could also be a situation which, you know, needs some monitoring. It could get radical in that space, you know, especially inside Tibet. In exile, I'm not too sure whether there would be violence in exile. Who would you, who would you fight with? Who would you fight against? You know, the Chinese are back home. Yes, there would be certainly a vacuum for a long time to come. If we go in that direction of succession, yes, there would be certainly a vacuum. And that is where the danger period lies. We would also need to take cognizance of the fact that we do not have the leading figure with us any longer. Would that mean a dip in international support for Tibet? Would that mean that? What do we have to do? As I said, my first question, how do we prepare ourselves for that eventual time? Do we have a blueprint? Maybe Dharamsala has a blueprint. Maybe they can't share all the details. But we as supporters, we at the ground level, what can we do to prepare our target audience to be prepared for that eventuality? So I think that is a question that we need to keep in mind. In fact, our report does discuss this particular aspect, and you can find those on page 78 and 79. Whether India will send back Tibet, I certainly don't think that will ever happen unless India wants to really be absolutely shamed and humiliated internationally. I don't think that is going to happen. Yes, there have always been tensions between Tibetans and the local community. That has its own history. It's been long. Then I think that is the responsibility of each one of us to try and overcome that. Can we not have better relations with the people living around us? They were talking about having better relations with the Chinese, who are our oppressors. So I think let us start small first. Let us at least bridge the community gap. So one should not have that fear, because we are aware that could be an eventuality, that could happen, and most probably it will happen. So why don't we prepare for something, to thwart that, events going in that direction, and, reach our hands out to our local community so that we don't face that eventuality.
So, not to reiterate what Ravindji mentioned, I think in terms of the report, I think it's saying that there'll be two successors and all of that, I think that's a given in terms of how China is going to play this out. However, I think as all of us know, His Holiness has already stated that at the age of 90, he's going to leave written instructions on how his reincarnation is going to process. So I think in some ways I would wait for that, because it's hard to think about the different aspects of it, even though there are a lot of different scenarios. It's really hard for me personally, and I know that there are others who have talked about all the different things that might happen and how to prepare for that. For me, I've looked at that, and I also think about at the age of 90, I would like to wait for that, because I think His Holiness is prepared for a lot of those challenges that we have talked about. However, I think the succession or the two reincarnations, it's also a very religious thing. It's an emotional thing. So if you think about the current pension Rinpoche, the fake pension Rinpoche, and the lack of respect that he has, if you see some of his teachings and people not going to it, and how he's being, how people are still yearning for the true pension Lama. So it doesn't really, I'm not going to say that it doesn't matter, but there is a question about how much legitimacy that fake that Lama will have, whether it's in the Tibetan space or the global space. And however, as I said earlier, and as Ravindji already mentioned earlier, there is a need to support the statement of His Holiness from a global perspective and from the Indian perspective. So I think that's important. In terms of the vacuum, yes. And I think this is something that is going to be felt in the Tibetan movement. However, I think I sometimes, when I look back at 60 or 70 years, I wasn't born 70 years ago, but if you look back at that, you can always see about how His Holiness has changed the Tibetan movement, right? In the beginning, when we first came into exile in the 60s, and the draft constitution that was drafted based on the Indian constitution, right? And the draft constitution, and talking about how Tibet is going to be a democracy, like in the 1963, the promulgation and all of that, right? And if you look at that, and how the members were being elected, how the first Kalyan Tripas got elected, and the members of parliament in terms of how it changed, and the representation, the semi-retirement and the devolution of power in 2011, all of these are preparing us for that. And there does lie a question about
will the Tibetan government in exile or the central Tibetan administration be able to take its space in the vacuum? I think there is a challenge. And to be very honest about it, we do have our own issues in the Tibetan parliament because it's a democracy. So there's always going to be, you know, democracy, there's always going to be like different opinions and all of that, and that's part of it, right? So however, I think the question is, will the Tibetan government in exile be able to fill that vacuum? Not completely, because there's no way that they can do that. However, to a certain extent. So I think this is something that is an important aspect of how we need to move forward in the next 5 to 10 years to actually make sure that the CTA is able to take up some part of their vacuum and provide their leadership. And I think there is a space for that. And I think this hasn't recognized that, the report. And in terms of the final question about the India, Tibetans and locals having certain small conflicts and stuff, I think this is something that is always going to happen, like when you have different communities living together. However, thinking about it, like being born in Dharamsala, like where this was one of the major conflicts that I saw when I was a kid, and living in Dharamsala for the last 10 years, what I've seen, the relationship, I don't see it as much of a big challenge. I think it's about understanding, right? And there's a lot of Tibetan groups, a lot of Indian groups doing working on that. There's the Indo-Tibetan Friendship Society who's trying to build those bridges. There's a Tibetan Center for Conflict Resolution which is trying to build some of those bridges, trying to build or resolve some of the conflicts. And if you look at the Tibetan settlements, there are like Tibetans who speak the local language better than some locals. So I think there's Tibetans, and sometimes when we even like we joke about the fact that we are half Tibetan, right? India is our second home. We're born here, a lot of us. We lived here all our lives. So we understand the culture. So we are similar in certain ways. So I don't see that as a big issue, even though there are going to be small elements of issues, which I think is a given. But I don't think it's going to be something that's going to be all over the Tibetan community.
Okay. Thank you so much. So I think we're coming to the end of the session. So I apologize for the lack of time for the question and answer session. With that, I would like to remind all that the not only Chinese militarization and infrastructure development in Tibet, it's an existential crisis for or a concern for India. But Tibet human rights violation, environmental, is also an existential concern for India also, and that. I'd like to remind friends that China continuous destruction of Tibet environment can cause serious threat to the lives of 2 billion who are dependent on the Tibet ecosystem, especially those people who are situated along the rivers originated from the Tibetan plateau, including India, and in the broader context could threaten the whole global water and food security. And I think all of us over here can agree that Tibet with the Tibetan Buddhists and culture of peace and compassion with that identity can provide a better security scenario than a Sinicized or Hunnized Tibet. So this panel discussion is just the beginning. We invite all of you to join us in the further research, discussion, and policy deliberation on this critical matter. With that, finally, I would like to read a poem that I've wrote on this centrality of Tibet. So the poem goes like, when does people really die? Is it when they are shot through their heart with bullets? Or is it when their homes and village are destroyed and demolished? No. Or is it when they are forced to leave their country and their mothers and sisters? No. People really dies when they are forgotten by others. With that, I request all of the brothers and sisters here and the people across the world to never ever forget about Tibet. Thank you.